Okay, let's get started. So I hope nobody else has their phone turned on. First part of feedback, very positive. Let's turn those phones off or put them on vibrate. Thank you, thank you. Welcome to Understanding the Science and Art of Receiving Feedback and Negotiating What Matters Most. I'm Jackie Nguyen. I'm the Vice President for our Global Cybersecurity Practice, part of RSA, which is the Security Division of EMC. And I'll be your host for this incredible session. And I know that there are lots of sessions today. And one thing I would ask you to do is, the first takeaway for me is to live it, claim it, and own it, what you learned today. Okay, can I get that? Live it, claim it, own it today. So that way you at least have one takeaway from this incredible session. RSA is the leader in intelligence-driven security, and RSA and EMC seriously support the advancement of women through not just programs like these, but other charitable contributions that you heard from our EVP this morning. Charity for Giving to Water, we just won one of the Great Places to Work Global Awards recently as well. When they asked me to be the host of the session, started Googling it, I wanted to understand because I think as women and men sometimes, you know, we have different ways of which we receive feedback. And I'm guilty as well, I was telling Sheila. So, you know, sometimes I've gone into my reviews and they'll say something. I'll be like, oh, stop it, not really. You know, especially if you got a really good one, right? me, you know, like, oh, my God. Or, you know, if it's not too good, you know, and I hate to say this, I mean, I have been known to get like a little emotional about it, like, I'm so sorry, you know. So I think, again, it's really important, the takeaway is women in terms of how we receive and how we process this. So with no further ado, I would love to introduce Sheila. She's a New York Times best-selling author, and I know there's been some confusion, so I'm going to put it up right now, is that she will be signing books right at the end of this. She'll have two book signings. So we're also probably not going to take questions because we're going to do some interactive exercises. But if you have questions, her book signings will be at 11 and at 4 today. So we really encourage you, if you have questions, to meet with her then. Sheila's the founder of Triad Consulting Group, and she's on the faculty at Harvard Law School. Her corporate clients include MetLife, BA Systems, the Federal Reserve Bank, Standard Bank of South Africa, Novartis, and numerous family businesses. She often works with executive teams, helping them to work through conflict. How do you repair working relationships? How do you make sound decisions together? In the public sector, she has also provided training for the New England Oregon Bank, the Singapore Supreme Court, and even the White House. She's been featured on Oprah, CNBC Power Lunch, and NPR. She's a graduate of Occidental College and Harvard Law School. She has spent also time working with theologians struggling with the disagreement over the nature of truth and God. So with no further ado, I'm going to introduce Sheila.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
What's wrong with this side of the room? The brave souls over here are homesteading, so if anybody wants more space, there's room over here. So, I'm Sheila Heen. I did spend 13 hours locked in a room with six theologians with pretty fundamental differences, all Catholic theologians, by the way, about the nature of truth and God. So I've got that all figured out now. But as you might guess, I have spent my career as a specialist in difficult conversations. So 15 years ago, we published a book called Difficult Conversations. It's now in 23 languages, and I have learned that people all over the world struggle with difficult conversations. And so what I've been doing over the last 15 years is traveling around the world, talking to people about their toughest challenges. And interestingly, as leaders, I used to think, well, eventually you just get so skilled and experienced and confident that conversations aren't difficult anymore. But what I have learned is actually as you become more senior in any organization, you actually spend more and more of your time having difficult conversations. because the challenges only increase, and you get what gets kicked upstairs to you because nobody else knows how to handle it. There aren't clear answers, etc. Now, the first thing that we always do when we work with a group is we ask them, so what are your most challenging conversations? What do you want help with? And we make a list. And we started to notice a pattern, which is that it didn't matter what continent we were on. It didn't matter what industry we were in. It didn't even matter why they brought us in. Feedback showed up on that list 100% of the time. All over the world, people are struggling with feedback conversations. So for the first 10 years, we did what I think most organizations do, which is that we said, okay, well, we can help you with that. We're going to help you learn how to give feedback more effectively, more skillfully, more often, more persistently. How many of you have ever gone to a session and learned how to give feedback more effectively? Yeah, was it helpful? Okay, so please say at least kinda, since that's some of the work that we do. But kinda, I think, is a very honest answer. Did it solve the problem? No. So we started to notice that, too, that we were teaching people how to give more effectively, but eventually it occurred to us, you know what? It's the receiver who's in charge here. It's the receiver who decides what they're going to let in, what sense they're going to make of it, and whether and how they choose to change. So maybe we've been coming at this totally backwards. Maybe the real challenge is in receiving feedback and learning the dark art of learning about yourself. And so what we're going to talk about a little bit today is what's captured in this latest book, Thanks for the Feedback, which is why is it that feedback is so hard? So why is it so hard? Let me just hit upon one thing that I think is at the heart of it, which is that feedback really sits, receiving feedback, sits at the crux of two core human needs. On the one hand, we do want to learn and grow, right? If you look at the research on happiness, getting better at things, achieving mastery, is a big piece of what makes us happy and satisfied with life, right? It's why we take up new hobbies in retirement. It's why we are so addicted to those games, right, on your phone. This will not help me with anything in my life, but getting a better score is really fun, right? It's completely irrational, but it's emotionally satisfying. This, by the way, is the only thing that explains the relationship between human beings and the game of golf. Okay? Because that occasional good round fools you into thinking you're getting better. Now, here's the problem. So here, we should want feedback. We should be thirsty for it to improve and to learn and grow. And sometimes, when you get feedback that is helpful or you have a coach that's really, you can see how you're getting better moment to moment, week by week, it's exhilarating. Here's the problem. This core human need sits right alongside the second one, which is the need to be accepted, respected, and loved just the way we are now. And the very fact of feedback often suggests that, well, how you are now is not quite A-okay, right? The people you work with and the people you live with want just a few upgrades, right, to your personality. And so I think this explains, for me, our conflicted relationship with feedback. Why sometimes it's actually a really great experience, even when it's constructive, and sometimes it's actually one of the most painful things in life. And yet, how many of you would say that some of the most important things you've learned in life have come out of some of your most painful experiences? Yeah, so what's up with that? Like, why can't we have a pain-free learning system? So this work is really about how do I understand the pain and how do I get to the learning faster so that I can make the most of the feedback I get, even though, by the way, most of our givers, the people out there giving us feedback, our boss, our colleagues, our customers, our clients, our kids, our teenagers, yeah, they're really bad at it. Have you noticed this? Right? So I have a choice. I can either try to upgrade my family and my friends to be better givers, and to give it to me perfectly at exactly the right time and exactly the right way, or I can decide I've got to take them as they are, and my givers are going to kind of stink at it. And yet I need to actually find a way to get something valuable out of it. Now, before we go any further, I do want to define our terms, because we toss around this word feedback. I'm trying to click there. There we go. We toss around this word feedback, and there are actually three different types of feedback. And we actually need each of the three of them in order to learn and grow. So the first is appreciation. Appreciation just says, I see you, I get you, you matter. I know that you spent the weekend and gave up something in order to get this to me on Monday morning. Thank you. You're seen. Sometimes when people say, I wish I got more feedback around here, what they actually mean is, I wish someone noticed that I work here. I put so much blood, sweat, and tears into this job, and it doesn't seem to even get noticed. U.S. Department of Labor study done a few years ago surveyed American workers and found that 93% reported being underappreciated at work. And of the talent that left their jobs to go elsewhere, they didn't get fired, they quit. Almost half said that being underappreciated was the primary reason they left. This is what keeps us motivated to keep improving. It's what helps the relationship. So we need it to keep morale high and to stay motivated to be there, to show up and be persistent and keep working at the problem. The second kind of feedback is, of course, coaching. Now, coaching is a term of art in the executive coaching community for a particular approach to coaching. We're using the term coaching here more broadly to mean anything anybody does that tries to help you get better, improve your knowledge, your skill, your ability. So it could be mentoring, it could be advice, it could be suggestions, etc. But the purpose of it is to help you improve. Now, there's a third kind, which is evaluation. Evaluation tells you where you rate or rank, how you stack up, where you stand, and what you can expect. Right? Should I throw my hat in the ring for the promotion, for the new role, etc.? I just need to know where I stand. Those personal life conversations. Where is this relationship going? That's an evaluation question. I need to understand where we stand here so that I know what to expect. Now, by the way, evaluation is the most emotionally loud. Right? Remember back in school, you get a paper back. What do you look at first? The grade, of course. Is there anyone here who did not turn immediately to the back to look at the grade? Once you see the grade, then you decide whether you care about all the margin comments. Right? But the margin comments are actually the coaching that's going to help you write a better paper next time. So this is what happens at work, which is feedback gets put off until the end of the year, until it's scheduled, until the person actually has to talk to you. They're giving you an evaluation, your rating, and your reaction to that rating can be so loud that it drowns out the coaching. And by the way, that's true whether the evaluation is worse than you thought, for sure, or better than you thought. Because if it's better than you expected, well, geez, I guess I don't need the coaching, right? So muddling these up is part of what gets confused in feedback, which is that appreciation gets dropped out, coaching gets mixed up with evaluation, and so nothing gets through. So let me actually ask you to think about your own score on each of these fronts. When I work with a team, often what I'll do is I'll say, all right, you guys think about individually how much appreciation do you get? What's the quality and the clarity of that appreciation? How much coaching do you get on this team? And how much evaluation? You don't need it as often, for sure, but do you have a sense of where you stand? By the way, there's a big move these days to drop evaluation out because it's so loud, et cetera. It rarely works the way that everybody wants it to work, right? So some companies are actually canceling performance reviews. What's everybody's first reaction to that? Yes! We didn't have time for this anyway. It's a pain in the arse, okay? And it doesn't help. Everybody's demoralized or frustrated or anxious. Forget it. Like, cancel the whole thing. Now fast forward about 12 or 18 months. What starts to happen? People can't quite tell where they stand. right? So we don't need it day in and day out, but we need every once in a while just to know, am I doing okay? Am I on track? Are you getting what you expect? Because if I don't know that, what I do is I start listening for it in coaching or appreciation. So, gosh, you got appreciated at the team meeting again. I didn't. Does that mean I'm not doing okay? How come I'm getting so much coaching? Does that mean there's a problem? Right? So we actually do need all three, but separating them out is really helpful. And so we do this evaluation of the different kinds of feedback you're getting so that you can think, okay, what do I want more of? And how would I get that? To take charge of your own feedback. All right, let me do this. I want to ask you each to think about a piece of coaching, a suggestion, a piece of advice, whatever it would be that you have received in your life that you did not take and have not taken. You got it? All right, here's what I want to know. Why didn't you take it? Just raise your hand. Yeah. Yes, because I didn't like the person who gave it to me. Right? So you're sitting there thinking, I was unaware I cared what you thought. Right? Great reason. Other reasons. Why didn't you take feedback? Yeah.
Fear.
What are you afraid of? Promoting myself. So if I took this, I would look like someone I don't want to be. Self-promotional. So they're telling you, you got to get out there and sell yourself. Right? Or speak about your accomplishments. And you're like, I don't want to be like that. And I don't like you, and you're like that. Right? Yeah. Other reasons. Yeah. It was just bad advice. Because it wouldn't work? Yeah, it wouldn't. That's an interesting idea. It's a terrible idea. It would never work. Nice. A couple more. We have some further back. Yeah.
When it feels like someone's projecting their own situation on you.
Absolutely. Right. So they're giving you advice and you're thinking, that's great. Okay, that's good advice for you. But actually, I don't know if you've noticed this, but I'm a different person. Yeah. There's a saying that all advice is autobiographical. And it's related to this idea that, of course, we all give advice based on our own experience. So, you know, I don't have the same experience or aspirations. Nice. Yeah, one more. Yes, the same advice would not be given to a man. How many people have had that thought? Yeah. So this doesn't feel fair, right? So you're giving me coaching that actually you would not give someone else. You would accept the behavior rather than try to coach them out of it. It just is fundamentally unfair. All right, so all of these reasons, by the way, for rejecting feedback are great reasons. Maybe. Here's the problem. We quickly decide whether to toss out feedback. We are incredibly good at what we call wrong spotting. As soon as feedback is incoming, I'm scanning it to determine what's wrong with it. It's not fair. It would never work. I don't even like you. I don't want to be like you, so why should I take your advice? And if we can find something wrong with it, we toss it out. Here's the problem. I promise there will always be something wrong with your feedback. Always. 90% of it might be wrong. It does come from the wrong person. They're worse at this than you are. It's the pot calling the kettle black. They said it at exactly the wrong time in the wrong place. They wouldn't say it to somebody else. And yet, 90% might be wrong. 10% of it might be something valuable. And so what I'm going to suggest, the challenge in receiving feedback, is not that you have to take the feedback. It's that you first work to understand it much more deeply so that then you make a better decision about whether to reject it or not, a more reliable decision. Now, as we started asking people, why did you reject the feedback? We found that actually you could identify three key triggered reactions that we have to feedback. And if you understand your triggers, you can recognize them and then handle them to try to understand what do I need to correct just to examine the feedback more closely for something that's valuable. So the first is what we call truth triggers. That's not true. It's a terrible idea. It wouldn't work, and it's not fair. It's about the feedback itself. Second are relationship triggers, all about who the feedback came from. All feedback lives in the relationship between giver and receiver. And we often have a bigger reaction to who's giving us the feedback than what they're saying. Another person could give us the same feedback, and we would have a different reaction. By the way, here's an experience I had recently. Tell me if this has ever happened to you. My husband comes home. We've been married for 20 years. He says, you know that new colleague I'm working with? I said, yeah. And he says, wow. He had the most amazing insight today. I think it's really going to help me to improve. I say, uh-huh. He says, what? I said, nothing. What? All right, I have only been telling you that for 10 years. Okay, I'm only the person who knows you the best and loves you the most, but apparently this practical stranger can say the same thing and suddenly it's from God, right? Who is giving you the feedback means your best friend can tell you things that nobody else can. But it also sometimes means that you can't hear it from the people closest to you. Because they're the ones you want the most to accept you the way that you are. They're the ones where the feedback is sometimes the most threatening. Finally is what we call identity triggers. And this has everything to do with the way that you are wired and built and your reaction to feedback. Well, I'm going to talk about this toward the end of the hour. When we took a look at some of the research on this front, three different strands of research, what we found is that individual sensitivity to feedback, meaning how far do you swing emotionally in the wake of positive or negative feedback, and how long does it take you to recover? Individual sensitivity can vary by up to 3,000%. Okay? Has a huge impact on how you experience feedback, and by the way, on the relationship between giver and receiver. Because if I'm pretty sensitive, I'm going to be very careful about how I give you feedback. You actually are not that sensitive. We all wish you were more sensitive, right? And so you don't even hear it. We'll talk about that toward the end. All right, here's what I want to do. Each of these triggers, truth, relationship, identity, corresponds to a particular challenge. The challenge to see what in the world the giver means, and see ourselves accurately. The challenge of we, the relationship, and the challenge of being me, my particular wiring. See, we, me. We're going to do the challenge of see first. I'm going to put up on the screen a sentence. It's a piece of feedback. I am going to bet that every single person in this room has at some point in their lives either received this feedback, given this feedback, or thought about giving this feedback. All right? You ready? So, let's think of actually five or six different things that the giver might mean. Imagine that you've received this feedback. What are five or six different things the giver might be trying to tell you? Just raise your hand. Yeah. You look so much better than you look so much better in those than I would. Oh, and so they're saying, I don't like the way those pants look because you're just showing me how much better looking you are than I am. What kind of friends do you have? I like that, actually. It's more about them, right, than about you. Nice, yeah. I want you to look your best when you go out, and what is the problem with the pants? They are too tight. Is that really a problem with the pants? yes, nice. Yeah, so those pants are great, they're fine. The problem is they're inappropriate for this particular occasion or event. They're too casual, they're too whatever they are, right? They're too low. I don't know what. Other things that this could mean? Yeah. You're gaining weight, right? So they were okay last week, not so much. Thanksgiving happened, yeah, put those away until at least February. One more, yeah. Yeah, so I don't like the way the pants look because it's a combination problem, right? So they would look fine with a different top, but not with this top. All right, so interesting, we've collected a number of different meanings that the giver could be actually trying to tell you. We've collected a few over the last few months. Here's a good sampling. Now, this is probably the most innocuous, right? Like, I just don't like those particular pants. Oh, actually, now they look fine. They just were a little wrinkled or something, but I think they'll probably be fine. So the problem is the pants. I don't like the way those kinds of pants look on you. That cut is not the best. Lose the pleats, whatever it would be. Now we're getting to what we all automatically hear, right? Which is the problem isn't really the pants. The problem actually is you. Here we have a problem. The problem really is not your weight. The problem is your judgment, okay, about the pants. This is a little bit more about the relationship, right? Like, you don't listen to me. You're humiliating me. Again, the pants. What's up? And then finally, it's just easing into a rather larger problem about where we stand. One of the things that's really interesting about feedback is that it often shows up like, I don't like the way those pants look on you, meaning it's a label. It's extremely vague. It's really hard to figure out what in the world is this person actually trying to tell me. So these are some of the labels that turn up frequently when people get feedback. You know, what you did was inappropriate. We need you to go above and beyond. You just need to be more proactive or responsive or be a team player, or you need to work on your people skills. In organizations, I ask people, so what are the labels that get thrown around here? And every organization has their own version of, you know, these are the kinds of labels that we hear in feedback. I was at Pixar last month, and one of the labels that gets thrown around there is hallway. Does anyone else have this phrase? You need to work on your hallway. Anybody know what that means? What it means is that when you're in public spaces, you go down to the cafeteria to get something to eat, you're walking down the hall, you're not friendly. You're not approachable. You need to smile. You need to make friends. Okay? And so people will get the advice. You need to actually work on your hallway. So what's interesting is that feedback usually arrives in these shorthand labels. And we make an instant judgment about whether we assume we know what the person means. What, you don't like the way those pants look? I know what you mean, and I'm already having a reaction to it. Before we actually work to understand what in the world does the giver themselves mean by it. Now, if you want to understand your labels, you can ask questions in either of two directions, because your feedback has a past and it has a future. So you can either pause to ask questions looking backwards, where is this coming from? And I don't mean which of your mental illnesses is this coming from, right? So where is this coming from? What's your problem? What I mean is the giver observed some things. They observed you doing things or not doing things that they expected. They have a set of implicit rules about how this should work, how you should act, how you should handle this situation, whatever it would be. And that's what led them to say to you, I don't like the way those pants look on you, you need to work on your hallway, etc. They have some implicit rules, expectations, and observations. Asking them, help me understand, what did you notice me doing, or maybe something I didn't do, or your feedback also has a future. You can ask questions, where is it going to? So if I were to follow your advice, and by the way, I have not yet decided whether I agree with your advice, perhaps, but if I were to follow it, what would I actually do differently? What is it you want me to do? And this will give you specificity so that you can at least just understand what they mean. One of the experiences that I've had is that I gave a piece of advice to a colleague that they needed to have more confidence. And they were like, oh, okay, yeah, I'll work on that. So, of course, not following my own advice, I did not explain what I meant. So I watched them in the next couple of sessions, and it's getting worse. And so I go back to them, I say, what's up? I thought you were working on confidence. They're like, I am working on confidence. And I'm like, what do you mean by that? What do you think I mean by that? And what was happening is that they assumed that being confident means that if someone asks you a question and you don't know the answer, you make up an answer. Because a confident person would know the answers, so they have to act like they know the answers, which is exactly opposite of my assumption and implicit rule, which is a confident person has the confidence, if they don't know the answer, to say, I don't know. That's a great question. Let's find out. Let me do a little research. I'll get back to you. That's what confidence means to me. But I was not sufficiently clear what are the specific behaviors I'm watching you do that I think are actually hurting your confidence. If you can ask questions in either of these directions, you will actually enrich the conversation itself. You can decide afterwards whether you agree. First, you just need to understand. Now, understanding is particularly important because of the challenge to see yourself clearly. How many of you ever watched yourself on video? Yeah, oh God. What kinds of things did you notice on video that surprised you, perhaps dismayed you, that you didn't realize you were doing? Yeah.
Head bobbing.
Uh-huh, yeah, totally, yeah. What else? Yeah. Talking too much with your hands. I don't have that problem. Yeah. What else? Talking too quickly. Keep going. Yeah. Saying exactly. So what's interesting is you have been with yourself your whole life. Yes? Anybody here not true? Just checking. And yet, in many ways, we're the person we have the least information about. Whose is the only face in this room that I cannot see? My own. And interestingly, when we think about blind spots, another blind spot, or maybe we should call it a deaf spot, is your own voice. There's a researcher in London named Sophie Scott, and she studies the way the brain listens and processes language. There's a little piece of the brain right behind your ear on each side. It's dedicated to listening to language. So it is decoding the meaning of what is said, but it's also listening very carefully to tone. Babies, up until about 6 or 7 months, root all sound through that part of the brain. And right around 6 or 7 months, they start isolating human voice. And after that, they're only paying attention with that part of their brain to human voices, tone and meaning. What Sophie has found right now, all of you, if you're listening to me, anybody not listening to me, raise your hand. That part of your brain is on. That part of my brain is off. When you yourself speak, that part of your own brain turns off. You do not listen to your own voice the way that you listen to everyone else in the world. Which is why when you hear a recording of yourself, how many of you are horrified? Yeah, exactly. So theoretically, you've heard your voice every day of your life, and yet it's the voice you listen to differently, which is why you're surprised. When it comes out of a speaker on a recording, you're suddenly listening to it through that part of your brain. It's called the STS. So this is one of the reasons why conversations are feedback about what you said, or tone of voice, and how you said it, are particularly hard to understand. Because you actually don't have the same information that everybody else has. Now, let me say one thing that you can do about this, because we're all about being practical here. To understand your feedback, you can ask questions backwards. Where's it coming from? Forward, where it's going to? Here, you can enlist a friend to help you. Now, getting feedback is sometimes called holding up a mirror, but I'm going to suggest that there are really two kinds of mirrors. The first is what we would call a supportive mirror. A supportive mirror shows you what you look like at your best on a good day, good hair day, flattering light. Okay? When you go to vent to a colleague, you get an upsetting piece of feedback. You go down the hall. You go into somebody's office. You shut the door. Oh my gosh, can you believe what he said? It's ridiculous. They'd never give that feedback to a guy. You know, and he's worse at this than I am, etc. What do you want from your friend? You bet. You bet. You want them to say, don't worry about it. He's crazy. you know, you're great, that's ridiculous, etc. Right? Now, let me ask you this. When someone comes into your office, they've just got an upsetting piece of feedback. They say, can you believe what he just said? Totally unfair, totally off base, it's terrible advice anyway, he's worse at this than I am. And what do? You say, he's crazy. Don't, you're great. You're a supportive mirror, right? Is anybody not a supportive mirror in that moment? Because I can explain to you why you don't have any friends. It is what the person wants. But when that person is venting to you and you're being a supportive mirror, how many of you are also often thinking, okay, you know, he is crazy, he's really difficult, he's worse than this than you, but he's not wrong. This is something actually that you could work on. How many of you are thinking that sometimes? Yeah. So now let's just think about the statistics. Our friends are often thinking that about us. So do ask them to be a supportive mirror. We need supportive mirrors to get perspective, particularly if you're sensitive to feedback, because the one piece of feedback gets supersized to be everything about you. You need to get back on your feet. And supportive mirrors, people who will be a supportive mirror for you, will help you get that perspective. The problem is we forget about the second kind of mirror, which is what we call an honest mirror. An honest mirror shows you what you look like right now when actually you're not at your best. And there is something actually that you could work on. By the way, I chose that shape of mirror for a particular reason, to be an honest mirror. Where do you find this mirror? In a salon. I asked this question a couple weeks ago in a room full of men. They're like, well, I don't know, I've never seen it before. I'm like, jeez. Yeah, so this is a hand mirror, often used in salons. What does it show you? The back of your head, right? Your hairdresser gives it to you, flips you around so that you can appreciate her good work, but also because that's the part of yourself that you can't see on your own. So your friend, when you're ready, saying to your friend, I need you to help me with two things. First of all, I need you to be a supportive mirror, and I want to just make a list of everything that is wrong with the feedback I just got. Because I have a top 10 right now, you can probably help me add to it. That'll be really fun, it'll be satisfying, and it will get you to the place where then you're ready to say, I need you now to help me with a second question. Is there anything that might be right about it? What's right about this feedback? Or what might be right about it? If you can get yourself to ask the first question and move to the second question, at some point, other people that you trust can help you see, all right, what is it here that I might pay attention to and think about? All right, I want to actually jump to the challenge of being me. And in some ways, this picture captures it for me. So you guys know who this is, right? Michaela Mulroney, London Olympics. She is on the medal stand. By the way, any of you familiar with the research about Olympic medalists? Gold, silver, bronze. Who's happiest? Gold, hello. They just won a gold medal. The gold medalists are happiest. It was not a trick question. But who is next happiest? Totally. Why? What does the silver medalist, what story do they tell about what just happened? I just lost gold. What's the story the bronze medalist tells? Yes! Woo, I medaled. Yeah. So, two things that this can teach us. One, the story you tell about the feedback you get makes an enormous difference in how you feel about it. Number two, I really resonate with Michaela because I think as high achievers, our biggest critic is often ourselves. And I think she's upset with herself. Michaela Mulroney was widely perceived to be, and for good reason, the very best vaulter in the world. She had won gold at the last five international competitions coming into the Olympics, and she had won by such a wide margin that there was no controversy, no question she was going to take the gold. The only thing people were talking about is who's going to get the silver and who's going to get the bronze. She fell on one of her two vaults. She still scored so highly that she still took the silver. But I think she's upset with herself. And I think that negotiating with yourself about, all right, what can I learn about this is key. Now, there's a formula that is sometimes talked about that will help us understand this part of being me. It's called the 50-40-10 formula. The idea here, and who knows what the numbers are exactly right, this comes out of the happiness research, is that some of your satisfaction in life, about 50% of your emotional well-being and sensitivity is wired in. It's just how you're born and how you're wired. Probably largely genetic. 10% is based on your actual context and situation, what's happening in your life. And 40% can be influenced by the story you tell about the feedback. So I'm going to talk about the wiring part, but there's a second chapter in this section that talks about the story part. How do I move myself from a fixed identity to a growth identity based on some of the work out at Stanford? So let's talk about wiring. We looked at three strands of research that actually impact how you handle and receive feedback emotionally. One is baseline. This is sometimes called set point in the literature. And the idea is that each of us has a level of happiness or unhappiness that's a natural place for us to live. So if the scale is 1 to 10, there are people who live their lives at 9. Everything is fantastic almost all of the time. And that sort of happiness, they show up a lot, by the way, in the resilience research, means that even, it doesn't matter if the thing is big or small. Like, we landed the client, that's so amazing. And that was a great cup of coffee, right? They're so cheerful, in some ways they can be annoying. Now, other people live their lives at 3 or 4. And the reason that baseline is important in feedback is particularly if you have a lower baseline. If you have a lower baseline, positive feedback is muffled for you. It doesn't land and affect you as the same feedback would affect someone who lives more like 6, 7. Okay, so if you have the experience of feeling like, you know, people give me positive feedback, I don't really care about it. Other people seem to care, I don't really get that. It doesn't really land with me. It may be because your baseline is a little bit low. Now, the two other things that affect it are what we call swing. When you get a piece of positive or negative feedback, how far does that knock you off your baseline? The same piece of feedback to you is devastating. To me, it's just not that big a deal, right? You have large swing and I have small swing. Now, if we're on the same team and we're each reacting to the feedback from the client or from our boss, you feel like this is a disaster. And I feel like you're totally overreacting. Okay, you need to get a thicker skin and not take it so personally. What's wrong with you? Is this helping? No. No, right? So my advice is well-intentioned, but it's completely worthless because your particular swing is partly just wired in by how devastated you will be or, by the way, how elated you are. The third piece, then, is how long does it take you to come back to your baseline, to either recover from negative or how long will you sustain positive? Let's just take a quick poll in the room. Let's start with positive feedback. You come in the morning, tomorrow morning, you get an email. It's from someone important. They have really positive feedback about something that you have done. How many people, that would like put a bounce in your step for at least, till lunch, till the end of the day, till the end of the week? Okay, so we've got some variation here in the room. How many people actually, that would make them happy for about as long as it takes them to open the next email? Yeah, okay, now we've got even more variation. Let's talk about negative. You get a piece of negative feedback in your email. Really upsetting, about something important and from someone important. How many people, it would take you the rest of the day, certainly, to recover? How many people the rest of the week? Never? why does this matter? The individual variation, by the way, can be up to 3,000% in terms of how far you swing and how quickly you recover, or slowly you recover. And by the way, positive and negative can be different. So you can have big negative swing and slow recovery, and very small positive boost, and quick quote-unquote recovery, because you don't sustain it very long. Now, this creates problems when you've got people with very different profiles exchanging feedback with each other, because it's hard for me to understand why you're reacting the way that you're reacting. But there are challenges on either end of the spectrum. If you are under-sensitive to feedback, or insensitive to feedback, I can call you insensitive because you don't really care that I'm calling you insensitive. Three challenges. One is you don't even realize people are trying to give you feedback, right? Particularly if they're being indirect. So they say, you know, Bill does it this way. And you're like, yeah, well, good for Bill. And, you know, it's only later, maybe, that you say, I wonder if they're actually trying to tell me something. Even if you do get it, right? You have a good conversation. You're like, okay, I get it. This is something I do need to work on. I have good intentions. I'm fully committed. I'm going to get better at this. It may not stick in memory, because memory is highly correlated with emotion, and if you don't have a lot of emotional reaction to the feedback, 6 months later, someone says, you know, remember we talked about this? And you're like, oh yeah, we did, didn't we? I kind of forgot. Sorry. The third is that you can quickly dismiss feedback, and there's an interesting pattern to how many of us dismiss feedback. People give us feedback that we're aloof or unfriendly or overbearing or impatient or elitist, and we think, well, that's just not true, because I know I'm just shy or I have high standards. So they're giving us feedback about the impact we're having on them, which, by the way, is a blind spot of how we're coming off or coming across, and we dismiss it because based on our intentions, what our real thoughts, feelings, or characteristics are. Does anybody, how many people here recognize themselves somewhere on this list? Yeah. So it's not that the right-hand column is wrong. The right-hand column is probably right. It may be that you're just shy. It may be that you have high standards. It is still a problem for you if the impact it's having on other people is that they feel you're unapproachable or they feel beaten down, etc. So that thinking, okay, how do I be clearer, more transparent about who I'm trying to be and my good intentions, and really think about how do I change the impact that I'm having on other people. I had a woman actually just a couple weeks ago say to me, I'm aloof, I've gotten that feedback, and I've actually worked on it. And the only thing I've changed is that when I walk into a meeting or I walk down the hall, I smile. Or I just, like, make eye contact. And she goes, it's totally changed the feedback that I've gotten, and I just didn't realize it was going to be that simple to start to make progress there, because I am still shy, but that's a step I can take in the right direction, and it is actually having an impact on how I'm being perceived. All right, so let me talk now about, to those of you who feel like you're actually quite sensitive. Let me say something before I show that. If you are very sensitive to feedback, and particularly to negative feedback, and are devastated by a piece of feedback, that piece of feedback can get supersized. And you can fall into what we call the Google bias. The Google bias is as if you are mentally and emotionally Googling everything that is wrong with me. And by the way, you get a million hits. All of your past mistakes, bad judgments, failed relationships flood onto your results page. You've got sponsored ads from your father and your ex. Now, we call this the Google bias because, of course, your search results are driven by your search terms. You are not Googling things I'm handling relatively well. If you did, you would get 5 million hits. And the truth about you is some combination of those. You're doing a lot of things really well, and there's at least one thing that one person thinks that you need to work on. That's really hard to see when you fall into this Google bias, when all you can see about yourself is your past mistakes and failures. And so it can affect your view of the past, the present, and the future, whether you're ever going to recover from this, whether you're a good person or not. This is the time where you really need those supportive mirrors to help you actually write your sense of self. We have a whole chapter, by the way, on dismantling the distortions of feedback if you get knocked into the basement and the feedback is overwhelming. So the first step, though, is that you have to dismantle the distortions before you can actually learn, because in the depths of this, you actually cannot learn. You need to get back on your feet first, and then you can say, okay, what's the one thing that I actually need to work on here? Now, in the interest of time, I want to just highlight a few takeaways, because I think that the biggest change that you can make that will impact your career and your happiness is your willingness and ability to take or receive, not necessarily follow, but receive feedback well. Despite the fact that everybody else is still doing it as badly as they have always done it, you can actually take charge of and accelerate your own learning. What the research shows us is that people who go out and solicit negative feedback, and what they mean by negative is that you're not just fishing for compliments, you're asking, what can I change and do better? Those people report higher satisfaction at work. They adapt more quickly to new roles. And they get higher performance reviews. How do you do it? Well, first, understand your particular profile. If you're sensitive, let other people know that. Coach them. Here's what you can do when you have feedback from me that will be helpful to me so that I can hear it. My co-author, Doug Stone, is actually really sensitive to feedback. I tend to be a little bit more on the even keel end. This means we have very different coaching for each other. If I forget something, I'm being confusing, I want him to interrupt and correct it. If he waits until after the talk, I'm pissed. You're telling me this now? Like, we could have corrected it when it happened. Why didn't you just speak up? He has the opposite request. If I interrupt him in the middle to clarify something, I have ruined the rest of the talk. He has to, like, leave. And so we just have very different requests, but when you're giving someone feedback, they know. They know how it would be helpful and how you might give it to them so that they can hear it and process it. So offer it when you're the receiver and ask it when you're the giver. First, work to understand the feedback, and there's a very specific question that I recommend to people if you want to accelerate your learning. Informally, pick one or two people and ask them, hey, what's one thing you see me doing, or maybe I'm failing to do that you think's getting in the way? Or adapt to the context. What's one thing I'm doing or failing to do that if I changed it, it would make this meeting a lot better? Or it would make this project work better? That question lowers the stakes because it's one thing, and you'll get something more concrete than a very vague label. Do this every once in a while with different people. You will actually get much more valuable suggestions, and you're demonstrating a commitment to learning and improvement. There's our question. And finally, let other people see you learn. The biggest thing a leader can do to change the nature of feedback conversations on their team is to work to become a better receiver yourself. And leaders are a key player here because they're usually the ones who are supposed to be giving feedback, but everybody below them talks about the feedback they want to give the leader. Have you noticed that? How many of you have feedback for your bosses? Yeah. By the way, if as a leader yourself, you don't know what you need to be working on, you know who knows? Your team knows. They actually have a list. They have a secret list that they pass around of all the things you do or fail to do that make it harder for them to work for you and to actually do the work and get it done efficiently and effectively. But you have to actually persuade them you want to know. So if you can do that, work to become a better leader, you'll actually get candid coaching, because as you get more senior, fewer and fewer people are willing to risk it. So you've got to work harder and harder to get it. So you'll actually get better as a leader. You're going to model what you value and what you expect from your own team. Look, I took the feedback from the client. I don't think it's totally on base, but I do think actually there's something valuable there that we need to pay attention to. And by the way, I expect you'll do the same, whether the feedback's coming from me or your peers or the people over in that other function who find us frustrating to work with. And then finally, you automatically become a more empathetic and skilled giver because you really understand the triggered reactions that we all have. And you open up the conversation, and the quality of all of your feedback conversations goes up. Good luck.